This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we explore the history of what our guest calls free market fundamentalism with the co-author of The Big Myth, How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. Now, the International Criminal Court last Friday issued arrest warrants for Russia's President Vladimir Putin, along with the Russian Federation's Children's Commissioner. The ICC war crimes charges are a response to the deportation of thousands of Ukrainian children to Russia. Here's ICC President Pyotr Hofmanskiy in a video statement.
It is forbidden by international law for occupying powers to transfer civilians from the territory they live in to other territories. Children enjoy special protection under the Geneva Convention.
We're going to talk about the charges and whether Putin could actually be arrested. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about this move by the International Criminal Court, about how war crime charges are brought and prosecuted? How do you want to see the international community respond? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Berlin is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University, where he studies international law, torture, and atrocity justice. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
It was just about a year ago, Mark, that we talked to you about U.S. calls for war crimes charges against Putin. Here we are. We have at least one from the International Criminal Court. What do you make of the release of this warrant and the particular charges made here?
Well, as the clip indicated, the charges relate to unlawful deportation of population outside of Ukraine and the unlawful transfer of a population from an unoccupied territory. Both are war crimes. This is a major milestone in the history of international criminal justice, it has to be said. This is the first time that a government official from a major superpower has been indicted by an international criminal court. And the first time in, let alone a president or a prime minister. And it's the first time in the International Criminal Court's 20-year history that it's indicted someone who's not an African. So historically, it's a major development. I have to be clear at the beginning here that there is basically no chance of President Putin being arrested and transferred to the court anytime soon. The International Criminal Court doesn't have its own police force. It doesn't have its own military. So it depends on the cooperation of individual states, governments, to go out and arrest indicted individuals and transfer them to the court. But that doesn't mean there are no consequences to this move, to this arrest warrant. First of all, it's hugely symbolic importance, I think, for the victims and their families. What's at issue here is the allegations of forcible abduction and transfer of children outside of Ukraine to camps and adoptive families inside of Russia. And so these charges, I think, are hugely meaningful for the victims and their family because it gives a name to the to what they've experienced. It's one thing to be opposed to this program, this policy of abducting children. It's another thing to label it as a war crime, which is something presumably the international community universally condemns. It's also highly stigmatizing for Russia and for Putin in particular. It puts Russia in the same category as other infamous regimes who have also engaged in practices of abducting children and handing them out as spoils of war, spoils of political conflict to their allies. So fascist Spain, Argentina under the military dictatorship, and even leaders of Nazi Germany were prosecuted for similar practices after World War II.
Now, we're seeing reports of a variety of war crimes being committed or alleged to have been committed, I should say, by Russian troops in Ukraine against Russian civilians. What makes the difference between filing charges or looking for charges against an individual, say, soldier, versus saying this is something that the head of the Russian government would be liable for?
Right. So, you know, the International Criminal Court's mission is to prosecute those with the highest responsibility for atrocities. So, you know, to the extent that that leaders at the top of the Russian government, like Putin, are responsible for this program, then it's the ICC's mission to go all the way to the top. Now, the choice of these particular crimes to single these out is particularly interesting. So I think last time I was on the show, you know, last year, right after the beginning of the war, I talked about how, you know, there's this fundamental challenge to bringing cases, these kinds of cases, that it's fundamentally very difficult to draw a line from an evidence perspective in a court from the responsibility of someone at the top, like a president, to individual soldiers at the you know, on the front lines committing war crimes. And we see a number of cases in the ICC's history of it stumbling or failing to complete cases because it faced problems in establishing this line of responsibility from the top to the bottom. Within that context, these charges, the prosecutor's decision to focus on this particular crime makes a lot of sense, because this is not a crime that's being committed, say, in the fog of war, where the responsibility is ambiguous. You know, the crossing the line from legitimate conduct to a war crime, you know, can be gray. And, you know, it's not clear if, you know, leaders at the top of the government are responsible for the decisions to, say, target civilians. None of that applies in this case, because this is a policy that is conducted out in the open, publicly, proudly. The Russian government has promoted as a humanitarian gesture to relocate these children to Russian families. So all of the issues about who is responsible and, you know, what the facts of the potential crimes are, none of that is really at issue here. It's very clear cut. The Putin government, you know, ratified this policy explicitly, has been promoting it. And so it's not really, you know, the facts and the responsibility are not really questioned here. So it makes sense that the prosecutor here is essentially picking the easiest types of allegations to substantiate in a court, you know, avoiding all of those normal problems that we run into at international criminal courts.
Talking to Mark Berlin, political scientist at Marquette University, looking at international criminal court charges against Vladimir Putin over the removal of civilian children, I guess obviously civilian children, from Ukraine into Russia as part of the unprovoked Russian invasion of Ukraine. Mark, the international court has countries sign on as signatories. Russia is not one of them. Neither is the United States. Does that affect this decision by the ICC?
Yes, it does. So Russia is not a member of the ICC, as you mentioned. So technically, it can say that it's not legally obligated to cooperate with the court on an investigation or, say, arresting and handing over suspects. Other big countries like China also aren't members. So if President Putin travels to China, then China technically is not under an obligation, at least at this point, to arrest him and hand him over. Now, there are 123 member states of the ICC, and they are obligated to arrest anyone who's indicted by the court and hand them over. So, other Russian allies like South Africa and Brazil, who are, you know, member of the so-called BRICS groups, group that has regular diplomatic meetings with Russian government. If Putin travels to one of those countries, like he's supposed to travel to South Africa later in the summer for a BRICS summit, technically the South African government is obligated to arrest him and hand him over to the court. So it'll be interesting to see how Russia handles that if Putin refrains from traveling to South Africa or other ICC member states.
Before we wrap up, Mark, you mentioned China. Now, Xi Jinping, a Chinese leader, visited Moscow. He's there. That's probably been planned for a while, but it happens just after these war crimes charges are filed. Do you see that as significant? If these charges are going to make a pariah out of Putin, well, the Chinese leadership doesn't see it that way.
Absolutely. So China will play a major role in how these allegations play out politically. In theory, these allegations have, and this warrant has the potential to increase Putin's isolation, make it harder for other countries to cooperate with him or provide him weapons. China's initial actions suggest that they are willing to give him some cover. They have denied the legality of this warrant. And there's ongoing discussions about how much China is going to provide additional weapons to Russia, which Russia really needs. So China's initial actions, you know, suggest they are willing to give him some cover, but they're certainly going to have to take this warrant into consideration now going forward, you know, whether they want to be seen as aiding and abetting an alleged war criminal, which also goes for other potential allies of Russia who might be considering giving them support going forward. And that goes onto the category of, you know, the actual practical consequences of this warrant. Like I said, there's no chance anytime soon Putin will actually be arrested, but there are certain kinds of practical consequences, like difficulties with him, you know, restricting his ability to travel around the world, you know, potential impact on other countries not being willing to, you know, continue to support him or support him at the same level.
Mark, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
That's Mark Berlin, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. We talked to him about the recent arrest warrant the International Criminal Court issued for Vladimir Putin and the Russian Children's Commissioner for the alleged war crime of deporting Ukrainian children to Russia. Coming up, we'll look more at what's been happening with the war in Ukraine with a UW-Russia expert. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this still on your radar after a little more than a year? What questions do you have about the latest in Ukraine and in Russia itself? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Yoshiko Herrera is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. Her research focuses on Russian politics, nationalism, identity, and ethnic politics, and international norms. Yoshiko, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
You've been listening along to the first part of our conversation, Yoshiko. What's your reaction to these International Criminal Court war crimes charges against Vladimir Putin?
Well, I think that the moral condemnation is probably the most important part. I think it also changes a little bit of the calculus for people in the West who may have been willing to cut a deal with Putin or give him the benefit of the doubt. I think it makes that much harder. So I think that it is definitely a victory for some of the victims, because not all the charges have been brought yet, but for those that the charges do affect, that is definitely a moral victory. And I think it does help strategically Ukraine make the case against Russia more broadly.
And then there's this visit, Xi Jinping of China, visiting Putin now. A lot of papers signed involving economic cooperation. How do you see this Chinese state visit as regards Ukraine, though?
I think this visit, to put it bluntly, solidifies Russia's position as a vassal state to China. The agreements are very one-sided. Russia is giving a lot to China in terms of trade, agriculture, IT, et cetera. And there's things we don't even know about yet in terms of military cooperation. And China has offered a very kind of empty sort of peace plan that says, let's just stop the fighting and, you know, hope for the best. So it's not really a peace plan that's likely to amount to anything. China did not offer any kind of serious lethal aid to Russia. They started out the visit by Xi Jinping issuing a statement saying that Russia and China are not in an alliance. So I think that the visit is very obviously one-sided, almost humiliating, in my opinion, for Russia. So I think that there were hopes, certainly on the Russian side, that they would get a lot more out of it. But I don't think that has materialized.
For the Russian people, will they even know about these International Criminal Court charges? Are they going to get the picture of Xi Jinping's visit and the deals made that you just laid out?
Well, the International Criminal Court is not held in high esteem in Russia. It's an international institution that Russia is not a party to, does not respect. And so And Putin's visit to Mariupol and to Crimea over the weekend kind of underscores his contempt actually for that judgment. So I don't think the conviction in Russia is very meaningful, except for, of course, people in the opposition. You know, it's something they would applaud, but everybody understands that Putin is very unlikely to be arrested, unlikely to travel to a country that would arrest him. So I don't think internally it makes a big difference. Putin may be trying to put a brave face on this by saying, like, well, it doesn't matter that we've cut off all relations with the West and we're never going to have a good relationship with Europe again. Look, we have this relationship with China. But I don't think that is actually a very popular position in Russia, because I don't think a lot of people in Russia are saying, great, we've always wanted to move to China and have that be the only country we can travel to. So, you know, he's trying to portray it as this relationship with China is, you know, a great victory and is a kind of a substitute for being part of Europe. But I don't actually think that's very popular.
And one concern, I think, on the Russian side is, are they going to have enough ammunition and shells to maintain the war in Ukraine? Is there any indication that some of that will flow from China?
Yes, there's already reports that, well, there are definitely reports that Russia is running out of ammunition. And actually, ammunition is a concern on the Ukrainian side as well. And there are reports that China is aiding Russia's war effort in different ways, in terms of drones, in terms of microchips, other kinds of technology. You don't get the sense of these game changers like the HIMARS or something like that. So it doesn't look like China is offering, you know, really important military assistance, but they may be offering ammunition in various ways. There are reports that Russia was getting ammunition from North Korea as well. So it's possible that they, and there were, I heard a report this morning that they're getting guns from China. So they might be getting some supplies and their war effort is being aided in some ways by China, but I don't think in a very dramatic fashion, and certainly not in what Putin and his people might have hoped for in this meeting.
Talking to UW-Madison political scientist Yoshiko Herrera about the latest news from the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Yoshiko, turning inside Ukraine's borders now, the war seems to be a stalemate in the active front lines in the regions that Russia technically claimed to have annexed now. What are you looking at there?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of focus on Bakhmut, of course. Many people have said this is not actually a strategically important city, but it's become symbolically important. It's something that Russia really wants to win. This Wagner group in Russia really wants to show a victory there. And the Ukrainians have been able to hold out for quite a long time. And so it's kind of become important to Ukraine symbolically, even though it's not strategically that important. I think the biggest thing is that there were great fears of a spring offensive by Russia and what that might bring. And I think a lot of analysts have suggested that that spring offensive has sort of petered out, that it started, they didn't have much to put into it, and there's not much more coming. Now, there may be some kind of Ukrainian response, which is able to make a significant change in the battle lines and the front line, but we haven't yet seen that. So I guess I'm sort of waiting to see what the Ukrainian response is, and what they might have in store. We know that there's more weapons and munitions coming, so there may be something. But I think right now both sides seem to be dug in, and analysts are kind of waiting to see what will happen.
When it comes to an end to the war, and we've talked about this in the past, Yoshiko, Russia wants pieces of Ukraine that Ukraine understandably doesn't want to give up, so negotiations don't seem likely to be successful. The possibility of a decisive victory by either side doesn't look like it's anywhere near. So what does that mean? Just long-term protracted conflict?
Well, I think that both sides at this very moment are committed to fighting. I think the International Criminal Court judgment just emphasizes one of the reasons why Ukraine is so committed, which is that they know that Russia is committing atrocities against Ukrainian citizens in the areas that it occupies. And so it's really important from a humanitarian perspective for Ukraine to retake those areas. It's not just a matter of territory, but it's a matter of coming to the rescue of their citizens in those areas. So both sides are very committed to fighting. It doesn't look like right now either side has the ability to win the war very quickly. But I think that there could be some changes coming this spring and summer with more supplies to Ukraine from the West. I think that's one of the reasons that Ukrainian officials and other supporters of Ukraine have tried to make the case that it's really important to get Ukraine the weapons it needs to win this war as quickly as possible.
And turning back inside Russia's borders now, Yoshiko, I mean, Russia was not known, I think, as a haven for free speech before all of this. Now we're seeing reports of people, you know, dragged out of bars for saying something disparaging about the war effort, a new law saying, yeah, it's illegal to criticize that Wagner group you were talking to. What effect is this having on the Russian people?
Well, for a lot of Putin supporters, it doesn't have any effect because they weren't planning on criticizing the regime. But for people who just want to talk about reality, for example, that just want to say there is a war going on, that's now a crime. You cannot use the word war. You can't say anything disparaging of the armed services or private military companies. So I think you're getting into an Orwellian situation where you're not allowed to say things that are obviously true. I think that people understand that Russia has moved further and further authoritarian, even more so than it already was since this war began, and that Putin is really maintaining his grip on power through the use of force and fear to keep people from the population from resisting his rule.
Yoshiko, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's Yoshiko Herrera, professor of political science at UW-Madison. We talked to her today about some of the latest news in the ongoing war in Ukraine. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, look at the benefits of social connection and the challenges of being lonely with the author of the new book, On Loneliness, How to Feel Less Alone in an Isolating World. If you have found a solution, a way to get out of a lonely period in your life, share that story now. Email ideas@WPR.org. Then join that conversation tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. We talk about cooking a lot here on Central Time on Food Friday, for example, and we often talk about the cutting edge of science and technology. Now they're coming together with a 3D printer that can make a cheesecake. As reported by USA Today, engineers at Columbia University announced the project in a science journal this week. You may have seen stuff about these 3D printers making tools, parts, toys, and such out of metals and plastics. And there have been some experiments with food as well. This is one of the more complicated ones with 7 ingredients: graham cracker, peanut butter, Nutella, banana puree, strawberry jam, cherry drizzle, and some frosting. Hang on, there's no cream cheese in that. So it's a non-cheese layer cake. Anyhow, they programmed the machine, put in the 7 raw materials. The printer produced the final creation. Why? 3D printing could be useful for astronauts, maybe the military, and yes, 3D food printers could be coming to the consumer market in the next couple of years. If I knew you were coming, I'd have printed a cake. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Join us Wednesday night at 7 for a rebroadcast of this week's Wisconsin Supreme Court candidate debate. Former Supreme Court Justice Dan Kelly and Judge Janet Protasiewicz participated in the State Bar of Wisconsin's candidate debate earlier today. You can hear the rebroadcast tomorrow night at 7 on WPR and at WPR.org. Now, in his first inaugural address in 1981, Republican President Ronald Reagan made clear his support for the free market.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
And Democratic President Bill Clinton would go on to echo Reagan in his 1996 State of the Union address.
The era of big government is over.
Our next guest points toward both of those statements as examples of an economic idea that became dominant over time in the United States, market fundamentalism. That's the idea loosely that free markets can meet all of our needs, economic and otherwise, and that government regulation and intervention inevitably distorts the free market in negative ways. For many Republicans and Democrats, this theory has become very influential. But our next guest says that free market fundamentalism is a myth built over generations by American business leaders in a long-running campaign of public relations and outreach that targeted government policymakers, the education system, popular culture, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What thoughts do you have? What questions do you have about the philosophy of an unregulated free market? Do you see a need for some government intervention, or is government the problem? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Naomi Oreskes is professor of science history at Harvard University. She's the co-author, along with Eric Conway, of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Climate Change. Their new book is The Big Myth, How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. Naomi, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I gave a very nutshell version there. Can you tell us a little more about the concept of market fundamentalism that's central to your book?
Well, that was a great nutshell, and I think I could pick up with the word intervention. So you mentioned that. You asked listeners, do they believe in government intervention, or should we just let the market do its magic? But the whole notion of intervention is part of the big myth. It's based on the idea that there is something called the free market that exists unto itself, that has a kind of wisdom, and that we could simply trust it, that we can have faith in markets to do the right thing, and we don't need governments to guide the markets or set rules and regulations. And that idea is a myth, because the reality is markets are human institutions. They're created by people. They go back to time immemorial. There were markets in biblical times, and the Bible even has a discussion of certain rules and regulations for the marketplace. People have always structured markets in the ways they felt they needed to meet their needs and to prevent damage. But in the 20th century, we were persuaded to think otherwise, to think that there was such a thing as the free market that could exist on its own and that didn't need the government to set the rules of the road. And it's that myth that we challenge in our new book.
Yeah, that's the story you tell in the book, is not so much the idea itself of market fundamentalism, but how it was promoted to the point where it became, I guess, a given, almost taken for granted. What were some of the origins of this in ways a very successful public relations campaign?
Well, the book begins in the early 20th century with debates that took place over child labor and something that was known as the accident crisis. So many people have forgotten or maybe never knew that capitalism in the early 20th century was incredibly dangerous. One out of every 1,000 workers was killed or seriously injured on the job every year. And that was the equivalent of 1.5 million people today. So imagine if it would be like a pandemic, a COVID pandemic every year of workplace death. And so this led to a big discussion about whether government should play a role in regulating workplaces to make them safer, and especially why there were so many more deaths in the United States than there were in Germany and the United Kingdom, which were also heavily industrialized countries. And the answer people realized was workmen's compensation, that these other countries had insurance programs where the amount that an employer had to pay into the insurance's premium depended on how dangerous their workplace were. So programs of workmen's compensation not only protected workers and their families, but also created an incentive for owners, for managers to clean up their act. And so a big debate took place about whether or not the United States should do the same. Many reformers thought the answer was yes. Teddy Roosevelt thought the answer was yes. Andrew Carnegie thought the answer was yes. But a small group of business people began to create an argument, the argument that we trace in our book, that the answer was no, because if the government, quote, intervened, and that's the word they use, if the government intervened or interfered in the marketplace, it was a threat to freedom. And that's the story that we trace in the book all the way through Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, and to the present day.
Naomi Oreskes is with us. She's the co-author of the new book, The Big Myth, How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. And with those earliest stories, you start with child labor, workers' compensation, rural electrification. You see themes emerge that come up, as you say, to the present day. One of them that comes up a lot, and this is in the child labor debate, I think, was something along the lines of Soviet Russia, the communists are trying to do away with child labor. If we do that in America, it's one step toward communism.
Exactly. And this is a key part of the argument. It's red baiting. It's to say that anyone who points out any of the failures of capitalism, whether it's child labor, workplace injury, the failure of the electricity industry to supply consumers in rural areas, that anyone who points out these facts, these realities about the way capitalism is operating, get accused of being communist. And this, of course, is something that we see again to the present day. People who supported Medicare in the 1960s, people who supported Obamacare in the 2000s, people who support the expansion of Medicare today get accused of being socialists or communists. And this is a way of shutting down the discussion and making it seem as if the only choices we have are completely unregulated capitalism run amok, or Soviet-style totalitarianism. And so a lot of the propaganda, the public relations that we document in the book set up this false dichotomy and make people think, or it's designed to make people think, that if you allow the government to address a problem like Medicare, for example, that you're on a slippery slope to Soviet-style communism, we lose all our freedom, and we're living in a new dark era.
A part of that outreach, and I thought this was interesting, targeted the education system at all levels. What were some of the earliest examples of, I guess, textbook wars over how we talk about the free market?
Yeah, and this is really interesting given what's going on in America today over textbooks. So one of the stories we tell in the book is about how the electricity industry tried to fight back against reform by distorting textbooks. So there was a group in the 1920s called the National Electric Light Association. This was a trade organization representing electrical utilities and the manufacturers of electrical equipment like Westinghouse. What critics pointed out was that the electricity industry had supplied electricity to urban consumers, people in places like St. Louis and Chicago, but had utterly failed to provide electricity to rural consumers. And this was a clear example of a failure, a market failure, a failure of supply and demand, because rural customers were demanding electricity. They wanted electricity, and many people thought they needed it even more, like farmers needed electricity even more than urbanites did, but they didn't have it. And they didn't have it because the industry refused to supply it because they didn't think that they could make enough profit. And so a group of reformers started arguing that the government should step in to remedy this market failure. In response, the industry launched a massive propaganda campaign. And it was propaganda. They were later investigated by the Federal Trade Commission, who called this the largest peacetime propaganda campaign in U.S. history. And the campaign was designed not just to persuade people that the electricity industry was great and we could trust them, but to change the way we thought about capitalism, to persuade us that any government action in the marketplace was a threat to freedom. And they did this by paying academics to rewrite textbooks, high school textbooks, college textbooks, to promote free enterprise capitalism, to promote an anti-government, pro-market ideology, and then pressuring publishers to adopt these new textbooks, sending free copies of the textbooks to thousands and thousands of libraries across the United States, supporting it with lecture series of paid, basically, shills who would shill for the industry, to persuade us that we just needed to trust the magic of the marketplace and everything would be fine.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kurt is with us in Chippewa Falls. Kurt, hi.
Yes, I really empathize and sympathize with the point that the author, I guess, is making. And I would like to point out that this is by no means something that had merely gone on in the past or the previous century, but is going on today. In fact, there is a private college in Michigan that boasts about being totally free of government, any kind of government, federal government support or aid, and it is promoting a nationwide course called Constitution 101, which claims that the free market is embedded in our U.S. Constitution.
Kurt, thanks for that call. Naomi, that is a theme you bring up your book, the idea that the free market is a fundamental part of American society.
Exactly, and I did not plant that call, but that was just a perfect call. Thank you so much for that, because that's exactly right. And that's part of the reason we wrote this book. This isn't just of historical interest. It's important because these arguments continue today, and they're being used even as we speak to justify rolling back protections for child labor, protections for workers, protections for unions. And I assume that the caller was referring to Hillsdale College. I get emails from Hillsdale College. They're very interesting. One of Ronald Reagan's most important speeches was a speech he gave at Hillsdale College, and we talk about that in the book.
Thanks for that call, Kurt. We're talking to Naomi Oreskes, professor of science history at Harvard University, co-author of the new book we're talking about. It's called The Big Myth: How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your reactions to what you've heard from our guests so far, how you think it does or doesn't fit the present day. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Naomi Oreskes, professor of science history at Harvard University, co-author along with Eric Conway of the new book, The Big Myth: How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your thoughts on the balance between the government regulating business, banks, worker safety, and more. How much is too much? Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Elizabeth is with us in Eau Claire. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi there. Well, I appreciate the author's dichotomy word, because I totally agree there should be a balance. But I want to give two examples, an old one and a new one, of maybe where government does play a role in safety. One was the shirtwaist factory fire, which is in the early 1900s, when all these young women burned to death because the doors, the exit doors, were locked. They either burned or jumped out windows from the ninth floor, and I don't remember how many, but there were lots. And the other one would be more modern day, would be the Palestine train accident recently, I think in Kentucky.
In Ohio,
when the train engineers didn't have enough. They were too tired, often too long hours, and there were too many cars to this train and several other things I don't remember. So,
Elizabeth, I gotcha, referring there to the train derailment in Ohio. Thanks for the call, Elizabeth. Naomi, Elizabeth giving a couple cases where she thinks obviously some regulation might have helped.
Well, exactly. And one of the things we point out in the book, and we actually talk about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, because that was a very famous and important example that helped to support stronger workplace safety mechanisms. Almost all of the rules and regulations that conservatives, libertarians, and others have attacked in recent years were put in place in response to problems like the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, to real problems in the way in which our economy was operating and the need for government to redress the balance. That the private sector had proven that you couldn't just trust them to regulate themselves. You couldn't trust businesses to create safe workplaces, that you needed government, you needed supervision, or another way of thinking of it is that the market needed rules of the road. So nobody objects to stop signs and red lights. Well, maybe some people do, but most of us recognize that stop signs and red lights and speed limits are necessary to keep us all safe and to enable us to drive on the road. Limited entrance ramps on freeways actually enable us to drive faster. So rules and regulations can actually be enabling. But in recent years, in the last 40 years or so, and you heard those clips at the beginning of Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton, the dominant ideology has been one of saying that regulations are bad and that the government just needs to, quote, get out of the way. And that's just not true. History doesn't support that ideology. And so we wanted to explain, well, why do so many people, including both Democrats and Republicans, buy into this idea, which is clearly false, not supported by the facts of history? And the answer we show is, to a very great extent, a long, complicated, and well-funded propaganda campaign.
Thanks for that call, Elizabeth. Tom joins us now in Milwaukee. Tom, hello.
Hi. I have a recollection just from the last few months of someone saying that the story Little House on the Prairie, when it was depicted on the television series in different forms, that actually the daughter of the author rewrote those things and made it free market friendly to promote that subtly.
I believe, Tom, thanks for the call. I believe, Naomi, that is something you tackle in the book.
Yes, that is a chapter in our book. So one of the things we show in the book is how these ideas were propagandized in a wide variety of contexts, including textbooks, including film, television, radio, and children's books. And the most astonishing story is the story of the Little House on the Prairie books, which I and millions of other American girls grew up thinking were the true life stories of Laura Ingalls Wilder on the American frontier. They were marketed that way. They were pitched that way. But in fact, the books were actually written by her daughter, Rose Wilder Lane, who was a libertarian, an extreme libertarian ideologue, a friend of Herbert Hoover, a correspondent of J. Howard Pugh, the president of Sun Oil Corporation. Lane, Hoover, Pugh, and others worked to promote libertarian ideology in America. And one of the things they did, one of the things she did, was to rewrite her mother's stories as libertarian parables.
Tom, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Naomi Oreskes, co-author of the new book, The Big Myth, How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. I want to focus in on this particular marketplace, Naomi, the marketplace of ideas. And you look at the influence of business and money in promoting scholars and authors and others who promoted the ideas you're talking about. Can you talk about how that swayed the messages people might have heard?
Exactly. Well, the Little House story is the most heartbreaking, and the academic story is the most infuriating. So we like to believe, and certainly I, as a Harvard professor, would like to believe that academia is a kind of refuge where ideas win or lose based on the solidity of the ideas, the evidence behind them. But what we show in the book is that the marketplace of ideas was grossly distorted by a group of business leaders with links to the National Association of Manufacturers, a major trade organization, and the DuPont Corporation, who paid the University of Chicago to hire a key neoliberal thinker, Friedrich von Hayek, an Austrian economist, and to set up a project at the University of Chicago called the Free Market Project. And the specific point of this project was to develop a blueprint for a free market or free enterprise-based America. They paid academics to write books, to write articles supporting free market against the enforcement of antitrust litigation. And perhaps most egregiously, one of the members of this project, the economist George Stigler, published an edited version of Adam Smith, which grossly distorted Adam Smith's argument, stripping out all of the places in The Wealth of Nations where he argues for regulation, for the role of government, for the rights of workers, and gives us this very distorted view of Adam Smith. But it's the view of Adam Smith that many, perhaps most people in America hold today.
Your book covers a 100-year-plus history up to the present day. Naomi, what are you hoping people take from this book and do with it in 2023?
Well, the main thing I hope, I'm happy to say, is already happening, which is a conversation. What we really want is not to try to persuade people what the right balance between government and private enterprise is, but to have a conversation about what that balance should be. Because we believe the balance is way off kilter in the United States, that we have excessively weakened the regulations that protect us as consumers, as workers, weakened the regulations that protect us against bank failure. We've seen that clearly this week. And that there is an important, essential role for government in protecting workers, protecting the environment, dealing with climate change. But we have been hamstrung in having that conversation. We've been hamstrung in using the powers that we have, even the laws that are on the books to address something like climate change, because of the dominance of free market ideology. And we think that if people come to understand that a lot of this was propaganda, a lot of this is not supported by the evidence of history, it will help us to have a better, more nuanced, and in the end of the day, well, a better conversation, and hopefully in the long run, more effective public policy.
Naomi, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Been talking to Naomi Oreskes, professor of science history at Harvard University, co-author of the book we've been talking about, The Big Myth: How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. Well, she ended with a kind of a question there. What is the right balance in any particular part of the U.S. economy versus leaving it to private enterprise versus government involvement? Love to hear your answers to that question. Maybe something that affects you in a part of your life or your work, or something you'd like to hear discussed more specifically, whether it's a healthcare policy, workplace safety, you name it. Let us know, and maybe we can tackle a future conversation about it. You could email us. You can do this anytime, but you can even email us right now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let us know your thoughts on the balance between a private enterprise and government regulation and what you want to hear more about. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, one of the goals of the Affordable Care Act was to boost preventive health care. We'll find out how that's worked out since the passage of the bill. And distracted driving is dangerous. We know that. But a report from a watchdog group says it's even worse than the numbers might suggest. Get the details and share your thoughts, maybe your experiences. Check out those conversations and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, former Wisconsin Badgers linebacker Chris Borland joins us to share the new athlete storytelling platform he's launching. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.